Good morning. Welcome to session 313, Controversies in Joseph Smith's Polygamy, Comparing the Opinions of the Experts. My name is Carrie Miles, and I'd like to introduce Brian Hales, who is our speaker. Brian Hales works as an anesthesiologist at Davis Hospital and Medical Center in Layton, Utah. He's the author of Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto, which was published by Greg Coford Books in 2006. He received the Best Book Award of 2007 from the John Whitmer Historical Association. He's the webmaster of josephsmithspolygamy.com and is currently working on a two-volume treatise on Joseph Smith's polygamy. So we're going to hear about that today. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thank you to Carrie, and thanks for coming. I never know on these first sessions if anybody will be here. 2 years ago, I think when I started, there were five people in the audience, and a couple of those were my best friends, you know, so it wasn't ideal. There are a few more by the end, but it's never a good feeling to have no one here. We're going to talk about controversies in Joseph Smith's polygamy. If you've looked at this topic, you'll know that there are quite a few individuals who have written in some detail on plural marriage and Joseph Smith over the past few years. These are people there. It wasn't that hard, actually, to cut it off. There are a few others that might be on the longer list, but these are the primaries I would include. Fawn Brody was the first to write a list of Joseph Smith's plural wives, which she expanded in her second edition in 1971. Gerald and Sandra Tanner, and I don't see Sandra here, I met her down at MHA, but this book was published in the 1970s and actually has some very good research in it. We may not agree with their conclusions, but the research is solid for the most part. Then Daniel Bachman did his master's thesis in 1975. This is from Purdue. A huge step forward. He uncovered a lot of new sources previously unsighted. And then while he was doing that research, Larry Foster was working on his PhD dissertation covering some of the same ground, but they didn't know each other. And then his work was published after some significant editing in 1984. Larry's a non-LDS observer and makes some very good observations and did some very fine research. Richard Van Wagner, you got to take your hat off to him because he was the first to try to make a chronological overview of Mormon polygamy. I would say that the first six chapters dealing with Joseph Smith's polygamy are very dated and problematic, but you really have to hand it to him for trying to put it all together chronologically. Michael Quinn has written about plural marriage in a lot of different books and articles. He doesn't deal directly with the Joseph Smith period as that much, but he definitely talks about it here and there. Todd Compton's book, In Sacred Loneliness, award-winning and deserving of such, is a huge milestone on the polygamy landscape. He uncovered new sources and put together some very important information. Gary Bergura, who I'm glad to see here, has written a number of very important articles and done some significant research on the topic. Richard Bushman, probably of all the authors, has written the least, but his book has probably sold more than any of the other authors except Fawn Brody, and so I've included him here. His opinion is worth noting. Michael Marquardt, in his book, 2005, deals with polygamy in some length and has lists of different types of wives and even quotes some sources that nobody else quotes. And then George D. Smith's 2008 book, Nauvoo Polygamy, contains Appendix B, which is a huge undertaking. We're all grateful to this. George put together a list of all of the Nauvoo polygamists and who they married. Huge amount of work. My books, it says 2011, that's wishful thinking. I'm hopeful MHA 2012 will have these out. It's two volumes sold as a set. I do have a website that was mentioned, www.josephsmithpolygamy.com, and I'll be referring to that off and on during the presentation. I've identified nine controversies that we'll talk about. Most of these have a history basis. My second volume is theology, and there'll be some controversies there. I expect a lot of pushback on some of my positions on the theology side as well. The first of these, though, is the Fanny Alger-Joseph Smith relationship. Was it a marriage or was it adultery? If you look at the ones who gave an opinion from that list, Von Brody and the Tanners, adultery, Michael Marquardt, George Smith, adultery, Quinn, Compton, Bushman, marriage. This is a list of all of the references I've been able to find referring to that relationship. There's 19, and that's it. That's all we have. There may be one or two pop up. It'd be great to find more, but we've looked real hard. This is it. If we're going to form an opinion about Fanny Alger, we're going to have to use these 19 documents. But what's interesting is there's nothing contemporaneous. The earliest we have is 1838. Then these are ambiguous. 1842 is a reference to it as being adultery. But then we jump 30 years, and we're dependent upon a lot of late claims and recollections to try to figure this out. Some of the evidences are ambiguous. We're not going to talk about those. Those that call it adultery, Oliver Cowdery referred to it as a dirty, nasty, filthy affair, or at least that's what people say. But if we look to the actual letter that this is in, and this is a copy of the letter. It's from Oliver Cowdery's copybook. This was copied by his nephew, Warren F. Cowdery. But we look, here it is, a dirty, nasty, filthy affair of his and Fanny Alger's. You look at that word affair, it's an overwrite. If we look more closely, we find that the underlying word is scrape. You can see an S here. The C is fairly easy to see. The R is lost in the F. An A is an overwrite, but there's the P, and then the E is easy to see. I'm grateful to Don Bradley for figuring this out. You know, I call him Sherlock Mahanrai Moriankumar Holmes because he's not able to look through the veil, but he gets pretty close sometimes, I think. The original word is scrape, and the reason I bring that up is a dirty, nasty, filthy scrape is still problematic, but scrape carries no inherent sexual connotation, and people who quote this need to call it a dirty, nasty, filthy scrape from now on, because we don't know who made the override. It's Warren's handwriting, not Oliver's, and so we don't know whether he put it there or if Oliver told him to do it. We just don't know. If we look at the second evidence here, it's Fanny Brewer. She quotes a rumor that she encountered in 1837, and this is from The History of the Saints by John Bennett. She said in 1837 she arrived in Kirtland, and there was the prophet. There was much excitement against the prophet, an unlawful intercourse between himself and a young orphan girl residing in his family. She wasn't an orphan. That's inaccurate. But this says that something was going on in 1837 as a consequence of the Fanny Alger relationship. Emma's actions are clearly supportive that she did not believe it was a legitimate marriage if she believed there was a marriage ceremony at all. We have some late problematic claims, but they're also supportive of adultery. Now, if we look at the plural marriage evidence, there's a new evidence just out in the last couple of years from Eliza R. Snow. If we go to the Andrew Jensen papers, and they're not even fully cataloged, but a still small voice told Don Bradley, and it was one of the church historians actually, that he needed to go look up this specific manuscript collection, and so he did, and it's the Andrew Jensen collection. And Andrew Jensen wrote, and he's probably talking to Eliza Snow, that Fanny Alger was one of the first wives Joseph married. Emma made such a fuss about. Sister E.R. Snow was well acquainted with her as she lived with the prophet at the time. This is important because we know that Emma boarded with the Smith family in the spring of 1836. People talk about when did this begin, and there's lots of opinions, but we can say with some authority now that the aftermath did not begin until after the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. And that's the spring of 1836. Eliza knew Fanny well, and according to her, to Eliza, and to her handwritten list, she believed that Fanny was married to Joseph Smith. This is a transcript of document one from Andrew Jensen's folder. The first 13 names are written in Andrew's handwriting, and then there's 13 more names in a different handwriting. If we look at the actual document, we can see here that this is Eliza's handwriting right here. She has a very distinct handwriting, the way she does some of her letters. Jill Durr and Don and I looked at these, and Jill agreed. But if you look at these 13 names, right there, Fanny Alger, and I argue that if Eliza believed that Fanny Alger and Joseph Smith's relationship was adulterous, it seems probable that she would have stayed quiet and not included her name. Nobody knew her name at that point. This was a brand new name to most Latter-day Saints. Evidence, we do have the Messiah Hancock statement that his father, Levi, performed a marriage ceremony. The manuscript is not without some significant problems, but if we look at the Webb family actions, and the Webb family is where Fanny went. when Emma threw Fanny out of the house, made the fuss about her, she went to live with the Webbs, and their statements and their actions would all support that it was a bona fide marriage. In addition, the Alger family did too, and then some late statements support some form of a marriage. You can go to my website and find this chart there. Click on each of the boxes, find the original statements if you're interested, and make your own decision. But unsurprisingly, I think it was a plural marriage. Controversy number two, Joseph Smith's 1830s reputation. Did it or did it not include licentiousness? And this is important because most of the writers imply or state that Joseph Smith had this little rumble or rumor that he was a philanderer, okay? He was a womanizer. In fact, the Tanners go so far as to say the charge of sexual immorality was probably one of the most frequent charges made against Joseph Smith. Well, this is just not supported. And if Sandra were here, I'd say, please produce some evidence to support that. There's only one published report between 1805 and 1842 accusing Joseph Smith of sexual impropriety. Now, I could be wrong, but this is all we can find. If you have others, please share them with me. But we've looked really hard. This one comes from 1834, Mormonism Unveiled by E.D. Howe. And here it is. This is a copy of it. Levi Lewis states that he has been acquainted with Joseph Smith and Martin Harris and that he has heard them both say adultery is no crime. Now, that's a little problematic because Joseph taught in the Book of Mormon that adultery was next to murder. So there's some plausibility issues, some contradictory evidence. But then here it is, one sentence. Harris said that he did not blame Smith for Smith's attempt to seduce Eliza Winters. Now, Levi Lewis is not accusing Joseph of seducing Eliza Winters. He's quoting Martin Harris. Now, Martin Harris was a very devout Mormon missionary during the early 1830s. For him to see Joseph attempt the seduction and then be this missionary is a little curious at best. But also, we find that Eliza Winters had at least three very opportune chances to corroborate this claim and never did. So there's problems with this whole sentence. But then we also go down here to the bottom of the paragraph. With regards to the plate, Smith said God had deceived him, which was the reason Smith did not show them. Well, we have eight witnesses that saw the plates, three more saw the plates and an angel. So this is blatantly false. So you're not going to find in this one reference of an attempted seduction anything very convincing is my position. After 1837, some private accusations were leveled in conjunction with Joseph Smith's relationship with Fanny Alger, but they did not spread far enough to attract the attention of the local newspaper editors, who were eager to publish derogatory statements about Joseph and the Mormons. So, again, I don't think that you can show, even from public or private publications or things that have been written, that he had a reputation. There is the blip dealing with Fanny Alger. Controversy number three, how many plural wives were sealed to Joseph Smith during his lifetime? There's quite a variety. Fon Brody had 48, but two were duplicates. Dan Bachman, 31. The Tanners published Stan Ivan's handwritten list, and it's actually quite a handy place to get it if you're interested. I've compared it to the exact handwritten list, and they are right on. Only 51 of these, does Stan Ivan say, were sealed to Joseph during his lifetime. Michael Quinn lists 46. Todd Compton, who I just saw come in, 33 plus 8 possibles. Richard Bushman accepts Todd Compton's 33, less Lucinda Pendleton. Gary Bergera, who's also here, 36. Michael Marquardt, 26. George Smith has 38, but one of them is Emma, so he has 37. And George is the latest list. He really doesn't bring any new evidence. He just draws the line a little more liberally, and that's what authors get to do. There's a gray zone there, and you just have to decide, well, I think she was and she wasn't. I accept Todd Compton's 33. I think Todd did a great job, but I also would add Esther Dutcher, a legal wife of Albert Smith. Daniel H. Wells wrote to Joseph F. Smith in 1888 saying, it seems that she, Esther Dutcher, was sealed to Joseph the prophet in the days of Nauvoo, though she still remained his, Albert Smith's wife. Not George Albert Smith. This is another Albert Smith. Now, this is a single attestation. Craig Foster and Noel Bringhurst in their book, Persistence of Polygamy, didn't think that was enough to bring her onto the list, and they have 33. I think it is, but again, these are the decisions that authors and researchers have to make. If you go to my website, you're going to find this list of virtually every woman that anybody's anywhere said was sometimes sealed to Joseph. These are the people making the claims. These are the compilers with me there on the right-hand side. If you're curious, you can click on each of these and find the evidence supporting that position. So I think 33 plus one more Esther Dutcher, 34. Controversy number four, did Joseph Smith have sexual relations with any of his plural wives? This really, isn't much of a controversy. Everybody agrees that he was having sexual relations with some of these. I presented on this 2 years ago, or was it three anyway? There's very good evidence for 9 of the non-polyandrous wives, some ambiguous evidence for 5 more, no evidence for 7. Controversy number 5 is, were there eternity-only ceilings? And we find that Michael and Todd both stated that there was no evidence. Okay, well, and George Smith as well. Well, we actually have found one evidence in the Andrew Jensen papers documenting, I think, one eternity ceiling. Here it is. This is Andrew Jensen's handwriting. He wrote, and he's talking about Ruth Vos Sayers, a polyandrous wife of Joseph Smith. While there, the strongest affection sprang up between the prophet Joseph and Mr. Sayers, the latter, not attaching much importance to the theory of a future life, insisted that his wife Ruth should be sealed to the prophet for eternity, and that he himself should claim her in this life. She was accordingly sealed to the prophet in Emma Smith's presence, and thus became numbered among the prophet's plural wives, though she continued to live with Mr. Sayers until his death. So I think, yes, they did, and whether Michael and George and Todd would have changed their position, I don't know. This is new evidence. Controversy 6, did Joseph Smith have sexual relations with women to whom he was not married? And this may be kind of a new thing, but I have been able... there's lots of different opinions on this. If you go to my website, you'll find that I've identified 24 women that... And I just want to point out... it's on the other slide, but these are women who are accused of being sexually involved with Joseph, and there's enough evidence there to try to investigate, could this have happened? And you're going to have to go to the website. We're not going to talk about any of these. But what's interesting is there's one accusation in 34, that's Eliza Winters. We talked about her. The next is 1842, John C. Bennett, and there's the bios of these individuals on the website as well. I don't think any of them are credible. And if you go to the website, you'll also find there's every allegation of sexual impropriety I've been able to find, I've put on there, and you can check them out yourself, make your own opinions, but I'm nonplussed. So I would say no. Controversy number 7, did Joseph Smith experience sexual relations with his 2 14-year-old plural wives? Yeah. We have Quinn saying yes, Bushman no, Compton maybe, Gary yes, George no, Michael no. One of these authors even said that Joseph proposed to a 12-year-old, which is unsupported. I think I know why he said that, but the evidence, there were 2 14-year-olds sealed women to Joseph Smith. And it is important to note that a 14-year-old marriage would raise eyebrows, okay, in 1842. 16 to 17-year-olds, probably not. 14, yes. But I argue that Helen Mar Kimball, even though she complained that she was unable to go to dances at the Nauvoo mansion, that she was complaining because the marriage to Joseph was preventing her from socializing. I think if she were sexually involved with Joseph, she would have realized that she was his wife and that these feelings would have not been as strong as she later related them. I agree with Stanley B. Kimball. He wrote that in 1881 in Utah, Helen wrote a retrospective poem about this marriage from which we learned that it was for eternity only, that is, unconsummated. Todd Compton wrote in his book that the evidence is more ambiguous. But I don't think anybody can say that he was sexually involved with 14-year-olds. To say that, they're going beyond the evidence for sure. A policy that was stated by Brigham Young several times in Utah was that you should leave the children long enough with their parents to let them have growth, strength, and maturity. I do not want children to be married to men before an age which their mothers can best determine. Go ahead and marry them, but leave the children to grow. I believe this began in Nauvoo. Can't prove it. It's my opinion. But I think that it's problematic to say Joseph was sexually involved with these 2 plural wives. And we know nothing about Nancy Winchester. We know that he was sealed her due to an affidavit in 1869. Otherwise, there would have been no evidence for that relationship at all. Controversy number 8, was John C. Bennett a polygamy confidant of Joseph Smith? And I'm going to give you the Cliff Notes version here, and I want everybody to come to John Whitmer Historical Association meeting in Nauvoo in September, and you can get the full story there, okay, because I'm presenting on this there. But the brief version, everybody says yes, that he was a close confidant of Joseph Smith. The traditional view is that he was a close confidant who, upon learning of plural marriage, perverted it for his own purposes. If we look at the evidence supporting that he was a polygamy confidant, of Joseph Smith, what we encounter first is that Bennett made the claim directly and indirectly. He quoted Joseph Smith saying, "It is known that you, Bennett, are well acquainted with all my private acts, better than any other man, and it is your power to save or damn me." The second evidence is that John C. Bennett roomed with the Smith family for the first 39 weeks that he lived in Nauvoo. And here's the homestead, and we usually think that this addition was put on after Joseph moved there, or after Joseph died. Though I was talking to Locke, and he's thinking that maybe it was earlier. I mean, we don't know for sure, but if he was just living in this part, there's an upper room, there's the entryway and the parlor, and then in behind this is the kitchen, and then there's another smaller room. But if they were living together with Bennett, they were having a lot of personal conversations at the homestead. But I argue that polygamy would not have been discussed because Emma Smith, the prophet's wife, was not made aware of the practice until 1843. On April 3rd, this is another supportive evidence, Bennett was presented as an assistant president until President Rigdon's health should be restored, which occurred 2 months later. But records indicate that Bennett never met with Joseph Smith or other church leaders. Meetings were held by members of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve many times in the months that followed, but Bennett was not invited to any of those gatherings, according to available records. The prophet successfully kept his own brother, associate president, and church patriarch Hiram Smith unaware of the principle until May of 43, nearly a full year after Bennett was cut off. William Law, who was appointed as second counselor to the First Presidency prior to Bennett's calling, reported that he didn't learn of plural marriage until 1843. So being an assistant president to the First Presidency is not a ticket to being a polygamy confidant, is what I would argue. Fourth evidence, John C. Bennett correctly identified five of Joseph Smith's plural wives who were married to him prior to March 9th of 1842. This is the excerpt from his book, History of the Saints. If we look at the ones he identifies, there's Louisa Beeman, Priscinda Huntington, Agnew Coolbrith Smith, and Patty Sessions. Elizabeth Davis Durfee is also on the list, but the latest date that we have is March 9th. So whoever he was talking to didn't know about wives after that date or very much after that. Missing is Sylvia Sessions, who several authors assert was sealed to Joseph February 8th. He also lists Mrs. G and Miss B, who have not been identified despite intense research by multiple authors. Did Bennett receive his information from Joseph Smith or from some other source? Important question. A possible source of Bennett's knowledge is Nancy Rigdon. Bennett served as Nancy's personal physician and published a letter that the prophet had dictated to her entitled, that begins, "Happiness is the object and design of our existence." Joseph proposed plural marriage to Nancy on April 9th. And may have told her about his previous sealings in order to convince her that the practice was legitimate and she should participate. Now, what evidence supports that John C. Bennett was not a polygamy confidant of Joseph Smith? If John C. Bennett learned of plural marriage from Joseph Smith, he did not use that knowledge in any of his writings or in his teachings. For example, Joseph Smith called his plural marriage the new and everlasting covenant of marriage or an order of the priesthood. Bennett called it spiritual wifery. Spiritual wifery was kind of a general term used by everybody to apply to religionists who were practicing something other than conventional monogamy. Bennett didn't coin the term. The Cochranites were called that, and were said to have been doing that, and others before the church was even organized. Bennett did not adopt terms like everlasting wifery, celestial wifery, eternal wifery, or spiritual marriage. Joseph Smith did not use the term spiritual wifery except once, and that was after Bennett was gone, and then he was mocking it. Bennett described three levels of polygamy or his seraglio. Only the cloistered sisters or saints needed to be married. These are just women who could have sex, and they didn't even have to have a marriage ceremony. If you look at the specifics, in Joseph Smith's teachings, he was restoring Old Testament polygamy. Bennett, no. There is an angel with a sword commanding it. Bennett, no. He never mentioned an angel. There was a ceremony required, authority required, worthiness required, a marriage relationship was established, could be eternal. None of these were characteristics of Bennett's description of spiritual wifery. He said no sin where there's no accuser. He allowed polyandrous sexuality. He said you had to keep it completely secret. Joseph Smith told people about his plural marriages. He didn't say you had to keep them completely secret. And then there's these three orders. It appears that the only similarity between Joseph Smith's new and everlasting covenant of marriage and John C. Bennett's spiritual wifery was that they both could authorize extra legal sexual relations. Second, Bennett's descriptions imply dozens of spiritual wives in Nauvoo at the time that he left there, which was July 42. But by that date, there were only four polygamists who were authorized by Joseph Smith. Each had married one or two, and I argue that Joseph had been sealed up to 10, but I argue that a lot of these were without sexuality, and we'll talk about that in the next controversy. But there is a very limited number of polygamists doing polygamy under Joseph Smith's authorization when Bennett leaves, and yet he describes this huge underground with the seraglio and all these veiled women and all these sexual relations, and it's just not there. I mean, he's making it up. He's a very creative guy. A third evidence, a contradictory evidence, is that in his 1842 publications, he referred to Emma as the Lady Abbess of the Seraglio or the Mother of Maids. Emma didn't accept polygamy till 1843. Again, just a definite prevarication. This is just historical fiction. Then, and this is significant, in a letter to the Iowa Hawkeye written in October of 43, Bennett admitted that he did not learn of eternal marriage while he was in Nauvoo. Here's the article from the Iowa Hawkeye, and in this article he states, "This marrying for eternity is not the spiritual wife doctrine noticed in my expose, The History of the Saints, but is an entirely new doctrine established by revelation, the spiritual wives for time, the celestial wives for eternity. Joseph Smith never taught plural marriage except within the context that they could be eternal. This admission that he never learned eternal marriage to me is tantamount saying he never sat down and talked with Joseph about polygamy at all. Maybe Bennett did know about eternal marriage, but was just sensationalizing. If we look at his book, though, The History of the Saints contains seven references to eternity, yet it is never used to describe the duration of a sealed marriage. Bennett quotes that the sealing ceremony used consecrated oil, which it never has. Bennett's version of Joseph Smith's marriage ceremony ends with, "May the peace of heaven, which passeth all understanding, rest upon you in time and eternity." Okay? In Bennett's version of the marriage ceremony, the marriage is not sealed for time and eternity. Instead, the peace of heaven is to rest upon the couple in time and eternity. Joseph Smith's sealing ordinances do not refer to the peace of heaven in any way, but the marriage covenants are sealed for time and eternity. Of course, since Bennett mentioned time and eternity, isn't it implied that the marriage could endure forever? Christian dogma taught of the dissolution of the marriage at death, which would not preclude the marriage, the peace of heaven, from continuing with the two single individuals in the next life. So it appears that Bennett heard about time and eternity sealing, time and eternity, but didn't know how they actually fit into the actual ceremony. And by his own admission, during the entire 20 months he lived in Nauvoo, he never learned, or even deduced on his own, that Joseph Smith was teaching about eternal marriage. The alternate view of John C. Bennett, the one that I embrace, is that it acknowledges that before he got to Nauvoo, he was licentious. His wife accused him of breaking up seven different families. This is before he even arrived in Nauvoo. And that he just continued his womanizing there among the Mormons, eventually hearing rumors of polygamy and exploiting them. So I disagree. I don't think he ever was a polygamy confidant. But come to John Whitmer and you'll get all the extra details. So. Controversy number 9, Joseph Smith and sexual polyandry. There is nothing that seems to be more questioned than this practice regarding Joseph Smith. Everybody thinks that he did. Dan Bachman, who was a CES educator, even said it might have happened. What historical evidence supports the position that Joseph Smith did practice sexual polyandry? Well, there are 11 accusations and reports of sexual polyandry which have been identified, and these are ones I've looked for. I've looked hard for them. If you have one that's not on this list right here, please share it with me. This is more evidence than any of the proponents of sexual polyandry have presented. Okay. A couple things that are interesting. First off, Bennett reported that Joseph was married to women who had legal husbands, but he didn't complain about it. He just included it in the list. The first person to complain about sexual polyandry was William Arrowsmith in 1850. Allegedly, the behavior had begun in 1841. 9 years passed before anybody complained about sexual polyandry. Most of the people in this room think that's pretty weird, if not just really problematic, but nobody seemed to be bothered by it enough to write something about it till 1850. And what's interesting is I have been accused of being in denial with respect to this issue. Somebody compared me to RLDS missionaries who would come to Utah and they would meet with Joseph Smith's wives like Melissa Lott, Emily Partridge, Lucy Walker, and they would say, yes, I had sexual relations with Joseph. But then the missionaries would say, you know, I just don't believe you, and they would leave. But if we look at the people who told us about non-polyandrous sexuality, It's a very credible group of individuals. Their plural wives saying, yeah, I had carnal intercourse with Joseph Smith. Nauvoo polygamous, friends of Joseph Smith. But when we look at who is accusing Joseph or reporting polyandrous sexuality, a very different group. Distant observers, anti-Mormons, ambiguous statements. So I would say that there's not a parallel here. You can go to the list and judge for yourself, but I would say there is no solid evidence for sexual polyandry among any of these. You might call some of them supplemental or secondary evidence if you had a couple of really good cases, but all alone I argue that there's no solid evidence there. Now, a second support, some authors have asserted that non-sexual polyandry contradicts the reproductive purpose of plural marriage. Joseph Smith gave three reasons for the establishment of plural marriage. Okay, one of them is to multiply and replenish, to create bodies for the devout, noble, premortal spirits. Okay, and that was one of them. There were two others, one of which is much more important, but it is a reason. However, this logic is problematic because from a physiological standpoint, because adding a second sperm donor does not enhance a woman's fertility. An ovum is fertilized. Sorry, I'm going to get a little medical here, but I am a physician, and I've run this by colleagues who are gynecologists and obstetricians. And an ovum is fertile for about 24 hours, and sperm are viable for up to 72. Sexual relations outside that conception window have no effect on fertility. Sexual intercourse leaves over 200 million sperm to fertilize a single ovum. The menstrual cycle generates one. Would everybody please turn off their phones? doubling the number of sperm does not greatly enhance the odds of fertilization. If the sperm are viable, a monogamous couple can repeat sexual relations when the woman is ovulating to increase the number. A second sperm donor is not necessary. This is just very problematic logic. So if we look at the evidence that supports the position that Joseph Smith did not practice sexual polyandry. First is to point out that ceremonial polyandry is not sexual polyandry. Ceremonial polyandry occurs when a woman has two marriage ceremonies, a legal ceremony and a religious ceremony, usually a sealing. And second, there's just no solid evidence for this. We looked at this list a few minutes ago. You can go there, or if you have something else, please submit it. I need it. I'll add it to the list. I've held nothing back here. Third, Joseph Smith taught that if a woman, after she is espoused, shall be with another man, she has committed adultery and shall be destroyed. And everybody ignores this. Nobody quotes this. All of the proponents of sexual polyandry just ignore this scripture. By ignoring Joseph Smith's theology, problems occur because the polygamists in Nauvoo did not ignore it. It guided their beliefs and their behaviors. By ignoring Joseph Smith's theology, it is easy to group all of his plural wives together by observing that he slept with some of his plural wives, and therefore it is easy to assume that he slept with most of them. However, Joseph Smith's teachings drew an important distinction between non-polyandrous sexuality and polyandrous sexuality. One is expected and the other is adultery. Without Joseph Smith's theology, it is difficult to answer the question, why would he marry a polygamous wife without experiencing sexual relations with her? And what I'm saying is that if we ignore his theology, it's easy to say, well, here's a group of his plural wives, and we can show he had sex with them, and here's another group of his plural wives, and so he's probably having sex with them too, because, I mean, the plural wife, you know, what's the big deal? And why would a man marry a woman and not have sex with her? That doesn't make any sense at all. But when we introduce Joseph Smith's theology, we learn that sex with non-polyandrous wives is expected. Sex with polyandrous wives in sexual polyandry is adultery. So there's this huge division or barrier between these two groups. But we have to pay attention to the theology. We also learn that Joseph Smith taught that exaltation requires every man and woman to have a wife. There are no single men or women in Joseph Smith's exaltation in the highest level of his celestial kingdom. And so here we have a reason why a woman who's married legally to a non-member or an anti-Mormon could be sealed to Joseph Smith and it be an eternity sealing and there be no sexual relations there. But we only discover this if we are willing to take into account his theological teachings. 20 months, fourth contradictory evidence, 20 months after the first polyandrous sealing and after dozens of people were aware of Joseph Smith's sealings to legally married women, he dictated DNC 132 that condemns sexual polyandry as adultery. Here's the timeline. The first polyandrous sealing was in October of 1841 at Zina Huntington, and most of the authors believe that Joseph was sexually involved with Zina. Then, during the next 20 months, he sealed to 12 additional women. There are 13 women who had ceremonial polyandrous relationships with Joseph Smith. Then, in July 12, 1843, Joseph Smith dictates a revelation explaining and justifying celestial and plural marriage. Now, if Joseph Smith had been practicing sexual polyandry, he might have authorized that behavior in a verse in the revelation. Wouldn't you expect that? Okay, and the verse might have been something like, if a woman is with a husband espoused by the law of the land, and she espouses another by the new and everlasting covenant, then it is hunky-dory and otherwise okie-dokie to be with her new husband as well. I'm not William McClellan. I don't pretend to be able to write Revelation, okay? But you get the point. You would kind of expect Joseph to do that. But the irony is that instead, Joseph Smith dictated that a woman in sexual polyandry has committed adultery and shall be destroyed. So what he's saying, and this revelation was circulated through Nauvoo much more than we have been led to believe by things that have been written. I found a number of extra quotes, and they'll be in my book, showing that people were taking it home, people were hearing it read out in the woods or in the bottom level of the temple. People knew, either having seen it or knew what it contained. And so what Joseph did is he says, all of you women with whom I'm sleeping with in sexual polyandry, you're all committing adultery with me, and by the way, you're going to be destroyed. The fifth contradictory evidence is that church members were watching Joseph Smith very closely, and I argue would not have tolerated adultery. It's impossible to prove a negative. And sometimes this can be promoted to become a positive, or actually evidence, promoting some idea, in this case, sexual polyandry. But no polyandrous wives reported it or complained. No polyandrous husbands reported it or complained. None of the officiators or witnesses reported it or complained. Anti-Mormons, including William Law and John C. Bennett, did not complain until 1850, 9 years after it reportedly began. Sixthly, and I think this is the primary reason why it did not happen, sexual polyandry would have single-handedly violated the commitments that the participants covenanted to keep through their sealings in the New and Everlasting Covenant. In Joseph Smith's teachings, adultery was next to murder, and sexual relations were authorized only in the presence of the marriage covenant relationship between a man and a woman, either a legal marriage or a time and eternity sealing in the new and everlasting covenant. But what about the woman who experiences both? She's first legally married and then afterwards sealed to an eternal husband for time and eternity. For example, Sylvia Sessions married Windsor Lyon and was subsequently sealed to Joseph Smith for time and eternity. Does the legal marriage covenant continue to authorize sexual relations after contracting a time and eternity sealing in the new and everlasting covenant? Was Sylvia Sessions still authorized to have sexual relations with Windsor Lyon after entering the new and everlasting covenant of marriage with Joseph Smith? The proponents of sexual polyandry, I think, would answer yes. However, Joseph Smith taught, "Behold, I say unto you that all old covenants have I caused to be done away in this thing. And this is the new and an everlasting covenant." He was talking about baptism at this time, but later on, specifically concerning marriage, he said, "Sexual relations with another man after entering into the new and everlasting covenant are adultery, and the woman shall be destroyed." A sealing in the new and everlasting covenant supersedes all old matrimonial covenants, that is, all legal marriages. They are thereafter done away. In the new and everlasting covenant introduced by Joseph Smith authorized sexual polygyny, one husband, many wives. And it condemned sexual polyandry, one wife, many husbands. Proponents of sexual polyandry affirm that participants embraced the first and rejected the second, which seems inconsistent and less plausible to me. There is no available evidence showing that Sylvia Sessions Lyon continued to cohabit with Windsor after her sealing to Joseph Smith, but after the martyrdom, she rejoined Windsor under the legal covenant. And they had children together. Okay, but some people have assumed that they were still cohabiting during the time she was married to Joseph, and I haven't found any evidence to support that. In fact, I find evidence contradicting it. Proponents of sexual polyandry would strengthen their position by identifying some solid evidence, by not ignoring Joseph's theology, by explaining the duplicity of the wives accepting and rejecting parts of the new and everlasting covenant, and by accounting for the lack of the reactions among believers and unbelievers to Joseph Smith's apparent hypocrisy. I've even added, and sorry, Carrie, I misspelled your name, but I put this slide together about a month ago, and virtually everybody believes that he was practicing sexual polyandry. I do not. whether some of these new evidences and observations will cause anybody to shift, any of the experts to shift on this, I don't know. Time will tell. And maybe they'll be pushed back. Maybe they'll be able to show some fallacy in the arguments that I presented today. And that's great. I think disagreement and discussion is very healthy and useful. If we look at all of these, you'll find that I'm kind of an outlier with respect to the experts on a lot of these topics, not all of them. But again, I think give it 5 years, 10 years after my books come out, and there's no good way to really make a comparison until my books are out. But it'll be interesting to see if the experts are still holding to the traditional views, or if these new observations and the things that I'll be including will have any impact in them. And there was some need to come up and
yes.
Say them so that they can hear it up here.
We're being recorded right here, so if you have a comment or a question, please come up.
You know, the other thing is maybe I can just repeat it into the microphone. Would that work?
Sure.
But remind me to do so.
And try to keep your speeches to 2 minutes or less.
Okay. Catherine Danes has a book called More Wives Than One, and I realize this is a later period. It's the Brigham Young period, not Joseph Smith period. But there, she tells of a story in which a convert couple comes to Salt Lake City, joins the church. They have two children, but the husband no longer can procreate due to some sort of an accident or something. They go to Brigham Young because the wife is concerned that she can't have more children for her eternal salvation. Brigham Young authorizes a man to father a child with this woman in a sort of a levirate marriage, kind of like in the New Testament Levi. So this seems to be one case in which Brigham Young authorized polyandrous sexual relationships. And so I'm just wondering, obviously Brigham has a strong influence on Joseph Smith, and could this be an example of where Joseph taught that this sort of thing was okay?
What he's talking about, and Larry Foster, bless his heart, just loves to bring this up every time I present with him, and he brought it up again at MHA. But he's talking about Mary Richardson, and what happened, you got the story essentially correct. They were members of a Protestant group that believed that two children was all you should have, and he underwent a sterilization procedure. They joined the church. There was talk that she needed to have children in the covenant because they were sealed together, and the only way to do that was for her to obtain a legal divorce, which they did. There's good evidence there was a legal divorce. She married a guy named Frederick Cox. He wasn't too wild about the idea when he was first approached. But he marries her for 3 years. She has two children, but because she's sealed to her husband and he leaves town, he's off working in a mine somewhere. There's no cohabiting between Mary Richardson and her sealed husband. She has two children in 3 years and then comes back and has a divorce from Frederick Cox and a legal marriage, which parallels the Seeley marriage. And if you don't think that's weird, believe me, I think it's really weird too, okay? But that is the best explanation. It's not polyandry. It's consecutive legal divorce and marriages. Now, Larry doesn't believe me, but the evidence is really good. And it's something that I've researched, and it's in my book, incidentally. We go through all of those details.
Marinda Johnson, you mentioned her at the chart of one of the possible polyandrous relationships. But my understanding is early on in the... when Joseph is living with the Johnson family in Hiram, the mob comes and takes Joseph out and smashes his teeth with the bottle of poison, etc. That one of the motivations for the brothers that are part of that group that come to mob Joseph is the accusations of sexual impropriety with Marinda at that time, early.
The question is, what about Marinda in 1832? Was an intimacy between Joseph and Marinda the cause of the, or one of the causes of the mobbing? I actually do talk about this in an article that was in the Journal of Mormon History, but I have a big section in my book. It's interesting that the claim that Joseph was intimate with Marinda was not made until 1884. There's nothing contemporaneous saying Joseph was involved with Marinda. a guy named Clark Braden, who was a Church of Christ Disciples preacher, and was pretty free and easy with his facts because he just came bullet making all these incredible claims against Joseph. This was one of his claims. It was picked up by Fawn Brody, and everybody repeats it now, not realizing that none of the people who were involved with it made the claim. There were people, anti-Mormons, who wrote about the mobbing during the period between 1832 when it happened and 1884 when Braden makes this claim. None of them list an intimacy with Miranda or any sexual impropriety as causing it. They all attribute it to the law of consecration that was unfolding at that time. In addition, Miranda left her own testimony that she never saw anything in Joseph Smith that was problematic. Now, she's terribly biased, but when you stack it all up, you just have to ask, where did Clark Braden, you know, 50 years after the fact, get this information? And when you see the rest of his claims and you learn about this guy, nobody wanted to debate him, not because he was such a great debater, but because he would throw out so many ideas that were false, you'd spend all of your time rebutting the falsehoods that he shouldn't have been promoting in the first place. And so I don't give it any credibility at all. And if you go to the contemporaneous stuff, there's just nothing to support it there.
You mentioned that if Section 132 would have allowed for polyandry, there might have been a verse there. And believe me, I'm with you. I would like to believe there was no polyandry among Joseph Smith's wives. But and you've given me some good reasonable doubt that I can lean that way on. But according to William Clayton, who penned Section 132, Joseph said that there was more to the revelation than that, but he said that will do for now. So we don't have the complete revelation, and we also have to keep in mind the audience that it was penned for. It was specifically penned so Hiram could take it and show Emma and convince her that this was of God. And there may be a reason that if there was such a verse that might have been in the full, complete revelation, you might understand why perhaps Joseph left it out of the version he was writing for Emma. And also, if we look at Joseph's associates to see how they understood it, an example may be Parley P. Pratt's marriage to his final wife. I think whether we have evidence that he had any carnal knowledge of his last marriage, I think her existing legal husband certainly thought that there was something going on because he killed Parley Boy. So it suggests to me that perhaps Parley thought that she was his in spite of her legal marriage. That might give us an inkling as to what at least Parley's view of the marriage, legal versus marriage for time of eternity, might have been.
You know, we're talking about Parley P. Pratt, who was killed by Hector. What's Hector's last
name?
Hector certainly didn't respect the New and Everlasting Covenant, but I think Parley fully did, and that's why he was very happy to have relations with her. I don't see in his behavior anything to suggest that he thought that the legal marriage was binding on him.
Well, and nor was Hector expecting to share her with her previous husband either.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that. Sad story. Wait, there was a hand back here. And then.
Thank you. You indicated that you did not think that Sylvia Session lived with Windsor Lyon for a few years while she was in the Everlasting Covenant with Joseph Smith. Where did that information come from, and do you believe that the daughter Josephine is, even though they're still doing DNA research, what does your research tell you about whose daughter Josephine was?
We're talking about Sylvia Sessions Lyon and any evidence that she wasn't living with Windsor while she was sealed to Joseph. The primary evidence that comes to me is when Emily and Eliza Partridge were kicked out of the mansion, and we don't have a time for that. It was probably late 1843. We find that Emily wrote that her sister found a home with the family of Jonathan Holmes and that she went to live with sister Sylvia Sessions. And that reference is quite curious. If Windsor was living there, you might have expected her to say that she was going to live with the Windsor Lyon family, as she had used the language with her sister. But it's clear that she's just going to live with Sylvia. There's no mention of Windsor. In addition, if you do the research, Windsor owned the store that you can view there in Nauvoo today. But he also owned the corner store, and it had a living apartment towards the back. And I've theorized that he was living there just down the street from where Sylvia was, because they had a child in common. The child died at age two or three, so it didn't make it out of Nauvoo. But there would have been parenting responsibilities to share there. And you find other references to people going to meeting Sylvia. Windsor's not there, or they're meeting with Windsor and Sylvia's not there. I think Todd and I actually disagree on this, and there, you know, it's not clear cut, but to me it's pretty convincing. But let's see, let's go here, and then you, Bill.
Can I get you to come up and make your comments on the tape? You know, I'll know how frustrating it is when you buy a CD and you can't hear what people are saying.
With respect to Zina Huntington, she was married to Henry Jacobs, Joseph Smith, and then Brigham Young, and then Henry Jacobs again. You know how many children she had by each of these men?
I'm not as surprised. We ought to ask Todd to answer this, because once we get past the martyrdom, I don't follow the wives very much. Zina Huntington was married to Henry Jacobs. We have two sealing dates for Zina. I theorize, and we don't know, and I'm not sure we ever will, that the first sealing date may have been her sealing to Joseph for eternity only. Henry was a difficult personality. Zina Huntington's first husband, Henry Jacobs, had four marriages, four divorces. If you read about his mission companions, they never doubted his devotion to the church, but he was different, and he was difficult on occasion. And I think that Zina may have actually been sealed to Joseph for eternity only, and then later said, you know, I think I want out of this marriage, and I'd like to be with him for time and eternity. But we don't have evidence of sexual relations with Joseph there, but they may have occurred, because we don't have evidence of sexual relations with Henry during the same time period. Am I getting that right, Todd? Do you recall? You don't remember? He's been doing Jacob Handlin for the last five years.
She had two children with Henry. Correct. There may be some descendants here. And then with Brigham Young, she had one child. Right. If I remember right, that's right.
Gary. Sorry, that's not the best answer, but I lose track of them right after the martyrdom. So, Bill.
You know, your argument is that since there is no artifactual or documentary evidence contemporary that Joseph had polyandrous relations, that therefore he probably did not. You know, William Clayton stopped at the bedroom door. He didn't go in, and we didn't have National Enquirer or people going around with cameras at that time. But what we do have is a pattern of behavior, and that is pretty solid. I think if I were to ask Craig Foster if he thought that Bill Clinton had ever had a polyandrous relationship with any a sexual relationship with any married woman, he probably would say yes.
Did any of the plural wives have a blue dress that was...
I'll look into that.
But we have no documentary evidence of it. For those of us who believe that the eschatology followed the sexuality and that sexuality was primary, what we see is a pattern of behavior. And we think that it is likely, in the absence of any such evidence, that that probably did occur on the basis of his personality.
Well, and I don't expect this lecture to change everybody's mind overnight. But I did make four recommendations for those who still hold on to it. You know, let's find some solid evidence if we can. You can't prove a negative, but that doesn't actually turn into evidence supporting the other position. We need to take into account his theology. I think that changes the whole picture, and everybody's been ignoring it. That's why it's gotten so much traction over the years, I believe, because everybody's just ignoring what he was teaching and playing like the novel polygamists were ignoring it as well. Let me throw in one additional observation, which is curious. If, okay, and I understand there's incredulity out there, and I don't blame you, because we've been fed this from every source for how many decades, but if he wasn't practicing sexual polyandry, what we observe is that he marries Louisa Beeman in April of 41. He has sex with her. We can show that. But then 10 out of the next 11 plural proposals are to legally married women. There's a huge pattern here. And people say, well, he just wanted to hide paternity. Well, I disagree. I believe that he's not having sex with these women. They were eternity-only sealings. There's no sexual polyandry, but he wanted these sealings because the angel was bearing down on him to practice plural marriage. He did it once, and then he's trying to seal all of these women to him for eternity in the hopes that the angel will get off his back, and also so he won't hurt Emma. People paint Joseph as having all these sexual relations with no thought of Emma's feelings. I disagree. I think he was terrified of Emma finding out about this polygamy, but he couldn't tell her at that point, because if she rejected it, then she would be destroyed, according to the revelation. But if she rejected it, then there would be consequences to her. So he waited to the last moment when she finally was able to sort of accept it. That's when she told him. But I see this as no sexual polyandry. He's just trying to satisfy the angel with these eternity ceilings. But the angel appears, curiously, in February of 42. Joseph had at least a half a dozen wives at that point. And what is the angel doing? Commanding him to practice plural marriage. Well, now that's a curious thing. He's been doing that for 10 months. He's got a half a dozen wives. What is not happening in those relationships that would make the angel show up with a sword telling him, do polygamy, like the Old Testament prophets? Three things happened after that visit. Within weeks, we find Joseph proposes to Nancy Rigdon. It's only the second time he's proposing to a woman who isn't previously married. We also find out that he's starting to contract plural marriages where we have good documentation of sexual relations. And thirdly, we find in just the weeks later, both Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball take plural wives. So there's a chronology there, and there's an interpretation. This is all new stuff. If you don't believe me, Bill, that's okay. But I think it's a very good interpretation, but it hasn't undergone scholarly review. So it'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Did Joseph Smith ask the angel if he could shake hands?
The question is, did Joseph Smith ask to shake hands with the angel? It's not in the records, but it is interesting when Joseph told Mary Elizabeth Rollins about the angel coming, she said, well, how do you know it wasn't an angel from the devil? So there is this concern about where are you getting your information. And if you go through the accounts, and I've got an article where I've got all 20 of the angel accounts, I mean, he got on his knees, he pled with them, he got the Book of Mormon out and pled with the angel, saying, look, it says we can't do polygamy here. It's a great storyline if it's all cover-up, which, of course, a lot of the skeptics will say, but it's a very consistent story, and those that he told, they were wondering some of the same things. So at that point, I don't know, had Section 130 been given? I can't remember the dating on that, but... I think you're just trying to be funny, but it was a good any other questions? We got a couple
more.
Minutes.
One more.
So there's a veiled reference to Emma Smith in the Doctrine and Covenants 132 about, and also Richard Van Wagoner talks about having Emma being sealed to, I want to say the stake president, but I can't remember the name.
William Marks.
And, and then the DNC 132 says something about, forget about what I commanded before or something. I mean, can you address that?
You know, I'd really love to give Don Bradley about 2 hours because I think he's figured it all out, and it's really remarkable. What I in a nutshell, I think what he's referring to is a divorce, not polyandry, and it was, I think, William Law, not William Marks. William Marks was never accepting polygamy at any level, even though he knew what Joseph was doing. William Law said in a letter that was published in the Salt Lake Tribune years later that Wilhelm Wilde had written about this wife swap, husband swap between Joseph and William, where Joseph would get Jane Law and William Law would get Emma. But he said, that's all false. Somebody's made that up. There's no truth to it at all. I did not accept polygamy in any form. So I think DNC 132 is talking about a divorce. There's good evidence that she threatened Joseph with divorce. And what's interesting is after the revelation was given July 12th, the next day they had a big meeting and they wept, and Joseph gave Emma all this property in case they did divorce. And from that point on, Joseph only married two more wives, and one of them, we have record, was with Emma's permission. The other one was an eternity-only sealing, the sister of Brigham Young. So from that point forward, they lived an outwardly monogamous relationship. People who lived across the street didn't know Joseph had plural wives. We have records of this. And I think he was not sleeping with his plural wives much at all from that point forward. And so they were able to kind of get the marriage back together a little bit.
Did you plan this with the upholstery with all of these millions of sperm on it? That's
Yes, I did.
We won't bother repeating that one for the tape recording.
Anyway, thank you for coming.